but not disoriented or anything like that. I went on, giving her as much detail as I could. I didn't see a way to mention the financial issue without admitting I'd snitched his bank books. I did describe his shakiness earlier that day, and Solana's report of a fall, which I hadn't personally witnessed. I saw the bruises and I was horrified at how thin he is. He looks like a walking skeleton. Do you feel he's in any immediate danger? Yes and no. If I thought it was a life or death matter, I'd have called the police. On the other hand, I'm convinced he needs help or I wouldn't be on the phone. Are you aware of any incidents of yelling or hitting? Well, no. Emotional abuse? Not in my presence. I live next door to the guy, and I used to see him all the time. He's clearly old, but he managed to get around fine. He used to be the neighborhood crank, so it's not like any of us were close to him. Can I ask you a question? Of course. What happens now? We'll send out an investigator in the next 1 to 5 days. It's too late to get anything on the books until first thing Monday morning, and then someone will be asked to look into it. Depending on the findings, we'll assign a caseworker and take whatever action seems necessary. You may be called on to answer additional questions. That's fine. I just don't want his caregiver to know I was the one who blew the whistle on her. Don't worry. Your identity and any information you give us is strictly confidential. I appreciate that. She might make a guess, but I just as soon not have it confirmed. We are well aware of the need for privacy. In the meantime, come Saturday morning, I had other business to take care of, chiefly locating Melvin Downs. I'd made 2 trips to the residence hotel without results, and it was time to get serious. I took the missile off-ramp and swung over to Dave Levine Street. I parked around the corner on the side street, passing the same used car lot I'd seen before. The converted milk truck camper offered at $1,999.99 had apparently been sold, and I was sorry I hadn't stopped to take a closer look. I'm not a proponent of recreational vehicles, in part because long-distance driving isn't a means of travel I find amusing. That said, the milk truck was adorable, and I knew I should have bought the damn thing. Henry would have let me park it in the side yard, and if I'd ever found myself in financial straits, I could have given up my studio and lived in style. When I reached the hotel, I took the porch steps 2 at a time and went in the front door. The foyer and downstairs hall were empty, so I took myself to Juanita Vaughn's office, first floor rear. I found her shifting the past year's files and financial records from the cabinet's drawers to a banker's box. "I just did that," I said. "How are you?" "Tired. It's a pain, but it has to be done. And I do enjoy the feeling of satisfaction afterwards." "You may be in luck this time. I saw Mr. Downs come in a while ago, though he could have gone out without my noticing if he used the front stairs. He's a hard one to catch. You know what? I really think I've earned the right to talk to him, even if it is upstairs. This is my 3rd trip over here, and if I miss him this time, you'll have to explain yourself to the attorney who's handling this case." She considered my request, taking her time about it so it wouldn't appear she was moved by the threat. "I suppose just this once. Hold on a second and I'll walk you up." "I can manage it," I said. Secretly, I was longing for the opportunity to snoop. She was having none of it, perhaps imagining I ran a drop-in hooker service for down-at-heel old men. Before she left the office, she paused to wash her hands and locked up her desk against the possibility of thieves. I followed her out of the office and toward the front door, responding politely as she pointed out features along the way. She began to climb the stairs, pulling herself along by the handrail. I stayed 2 steps behind her, listening to her labored breathing as we reached the 2nd floor. "This sitting area on the landing is where the tenants gather of an evening. I provide the color television set, and I ask them to be considerate about what they watch. Can't have one individual making all the choices for the group." The landing was large enough to accommodate 2 couches, a wide-armed upholstered chair, and 3 smaller wooden chairs, all with padded seats. I pictured a bunch of old guys with their feet on the coffee table, commenting on sports and cop shows. We turned to the right into a short corridor, at the end of which she showed me a big glass-enclosed sun porch and a laundry room. We went down two steps to a hallway that extended along the length of the house. All the room doors were closed, but each had a small brass slot with a card in it, printed with the name of the occupant. I watched the brass numbers climb from 1 to 8, which meant that Melvin Downs's room was probably at the rear of the building, near the top of the back stairs. We rounded the corner and started up the next flight. It felt like it took 6 minutes getting from the first floor to the third, but eventually we reached the top. I sincerely hoped she didn't intend to hang around to supervise my conversation with Downs. She accompanied me to his room and had me step to one side while she knocked on his door. She stood politely with her hands crossed in front of her, giving him time to assemble himself and answer the door. "Must have gone out again," she remarked, as though I wasn't bright enough to figure that out myself. She tilted her head. "Hold on a minute. Oh, that might be him now." Belatedly, I caught the sound of someone coming up the back stairs. A white-haired man appeared, carrying two empty cardboard wine boxes, one tucked inside the other. He had a long face and pointed elfin ears. Age had eroded channels in his face, and there were deep creases worn into each side of his mouth. Juanita Vaughn brightened. "There you are! I told Miss Milhone it might be you coming up the stairs. You have a visitor." He was wearing the rumored black wing-tip shoes and the brown leather bomber jacket I'd heard about before. I felt myself smiling and realized, until now, I hadn't been convinced that he existed at all. I held my hand out. "How are you, Mr. Downs? I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm delighted to catch up with you." His handshake was firm and his manner friendly, underlaid with an element of puzzlement. "I'm not sure I know what this is about." Mrs. Vaughn stirred, saying, "I'll get back to my work and leave the two of you to talk. With respect to the house rules, I don't allow young ladies to visit in the tenants' rooms with the doors shut. If you'll be more than 10 minutes, you can have your conversation in the parlor, which is more appropriate than standing in the hall." I said, "Thanks." "No trouble," she said. "Long as I'm up here, I'll look in on Mr. Bowie. He's been under the weather." "Fine," I said. "I know my way out." She moved down the stairs, and I turned my attention to Downs. "Would you prefer to talk in the parlor?" The bus driver on my route told me someone had come around asking questions about me. "That's all he said?" "Well, I'm sorry if I took you by surprise. I told him he could fill you in. I saw the flyer that said something about a car crash, but I've never been in one." I took a few minutes to go through my oft-repeated tale about the accident, the lawsuit, and the questions we had about what he'd seen at the time. He stared at me. "How did you manage to locate me? I don't know anyone in town." "That was a stroke of luck. I distributed flyers in the neighborhood where the collision occurred. That must have been one of the ones you saw. I included a brief description, and a woman called me saying she'd seen you at the bus stop across from City College. I called MTA, got the route number, and then chatted with the bus driver. He was the one who gave me your name and address." "You go to this much trouble for something that happened 7 months ago? That can't be true. Why now, after all this time?" "The lawsuit wasn't filed until recently," I said. "Is this upsetting you? Because that wasn't my intention. I just want to ask a few questions about the accident so we can figure out what went on and who was at fault. That's all this is about." He seemed to pull himself together and shift gears. "I don't have anything to say. It's been months. Maybe I can help refresh your memory. I'm sorry, but I have something I need to take care of. Maybe another day." "This won't take long. Just a few quick questions and I'll be out of your hair, please." After a pause, he said, "All right, but I don't remember much. It didn't seem important, even at the time." "I understand," I said. "If you'll recollect, this was the Thursday before Memorial Day weekend." "Sounds about right. You were on your way home from work?" He hesitated. "What difference does that make?" "I'm just trying to get a feel for the sequence of events. After work, then. That's right. I was waiting for my bus, and when I looked up, I saw a young woman in a white car pull forward, preparing to turn left out of the City College parking lot. He came to a stop, as though calculating his responses so he could offer the least information possible without being obvious. And the other car? The van was coming from the direction of Capillo Hill. Heading east, I said. I was trying to encourage a response without too much prompting. I didn't want him simply feeding back the information I fed him. The driver was signaling a right-hand turn, and I saw him slow. He stopped. I shut my mouth and stood there, creating one of those conversational vacuums that usually goads the other guy to speak. I watched him avidly, willing him to proceed. Before the girl in the first car completed the turn, the driver in the van accelerated and rammed right into her. I felt my heart give a thump. He accelerated? Yes, deliberately. That's what I said. Why would he do that? Didn't it seem weird? I didn't have time to think about it. I ran out to see if I could help. It didn't look like the girl was seriously hurt, but the passenger, an older woman, had big problems. I could see it in her face. I did what I could, though it didn't amount to much. The younger woman, Ms. Ray, had wanted to thank you for your kindness, but she says the next thing she knew, you'd disappeared. I'd done as much as I could. Someone must have dialed 911. I could hear the sirens, so I knew help was on the way. I went back to the bus stop, and when the bus came, I got on. That's as much as I know. I can't tell you how helpful you've been. This is just what we need. The defendant's attorney will want to take your deposition. He looked at me as though I'd struck him in the face. You never said anything about a deposition. I thought I mentioned it. It's no big deal. Mr. Effinger will go through this again for the record, the same sort of questions, but you don't have to worry about that now. You'll get plenty of notice, and I'm sure he can set it up so you won't have to miss work. I didn't say I'd testify about anything. You might not have to. The suit might be dropped or settled, and you'll be off the hook. I answered your questions. Isn't that enough? Look, I know it's a pain. Nobody likes to get caught up in these things. I can have him call you. I don't have a phone. Mrs. Vaughn isn't good about messages. Why don't I give you his number and you can contact him? That way you can do it at your convenience. I took out my notebook and scribbled Lowell Effinger's name and office number. I said, I'm sorry for the misunderstanding. I should have made myself clear. As I indicated, there's an outside possibility the matter will be resolved. Even if you testify, Mr. Effinger will make it as painless as possible. I can promise you that. When I tore off the leaf and passed it to him, I caught sight of his right hand. A crude tattoo was visible in the webbing between the thumb and index finger. The area was rimmed with what looked like lipstick red that had faded over time. Two round black dots sat on either side of his knuckle. My first thought was prison, which might explain his attitude. If he'd had legal problems in the past, it could account for his bulkiness. He put his hand in his pocket. I glanced away, feigning interest in the decor. Interesting place. How long have you lived here? He shook his head. I don't have time to chat. No problem. I appreciate your time. As soon as I reached my desk, I put a call through to Lowell Effinger's office, which was closed for the weekend. His machine picked up, and I left a message for Geneva Burt, giving her Melvin Downs's name and address. I said, "Don't let it wait. This guy seems antsy. If you don't hear from him first thing Monday, call his landlady, Mrs. Vaughn. She's a tough old bird, and she'll crack the whip." I gave her the number that rang into Juanita Vaughn's office. Chapter 23. Having made the call to the county agency that dealt with elder abuse, I expected to feel relieved. The matter was out of my hands, and the investigation of Solana Rojas was someone else's responsibility. In reality, I was uneasy about running into her. I'd worked hard to ingratiate myself in an effort to gain access to Gus. But if I cut off all contact and the investigator showed up asking pointed questions, the obvious conclusion would be that I'd made the call, which of course I had. I didn't know how to maintain even the semblance of innocence. In my heart, I knew Gus's safety took precedence over the risk of Solana's wrath, but I fretted nonetheless. Consummate liar that I am, I was now fearful she'd accuse me of telling the truth. This is how the system works. A citizen sees an instance of wrongdoing and calls it to the attention of the proper authorities. Instead of being lauded, an aura of guilt attaches. I'd done what I thought was right, and now I felt like skulking around, avoiding the sight of her. I could tell myself all day long I was being silly, but I was afraid for Gus, worried he'd paid the price for the call I'd made. Solana wasn't a normal human being. She had a ruthless streak, and the minute she figured out what I'd done, she was going to crawl up in my hair and take a shit. It didn't help that we lived in such proximity. I unburdened myself to Henry, sitting in his kitchen at the cocktail hour, he with blackjack over ice, me with my Chardonnay. "Don't you have business that might take you out of town?" he asked. "Don't I wish. Actually, if I were gone, suspicion would fall on you." He waved that worry aside. "I can handle Solana. So can you, if it comes down to it. You did the right thing. That's what I keep telling myself. But I do have one teeny tiny transgression to confess." He said, "Oh, Lord. It's not that bad. The day I was helping Solana with Gus, I took advantage of the moment to lift his check register and one of the passbooks for a savings account." "Lift, as in stole?" "Well, yes, if you want to be blunt. That's what prompted me to make the call to the county. It was the first proof I'd seen that she was draining his accounts. The problem is, now that she's changed the locks, I don't have a way to put them back. Oh, boy. Oh, boy is right. What am I supposed to do? If I hang on to the documents, I can't keep them at my place. What if she figures it out, calls the cops, and gets a search warrant? Why can't you put them in your safe deposit box? But I'd still risk getting caught with them. At the same time, I can't destroy them, because if Solana's charged with a crime, that would be evidence. Actually, if I'm charged with a crime, it's evidence against me." Henry was shaking his head in disagreement. "Don't think so, for three reasons. The documents are inadmissible because they're fruit of the poison tree. Isn't that what it's called when evidence is illegally obtained?" "Pretty much. Besides which, the bank has the same records. So, if push comes to shove, the DA's office can subpoena the records from them." "What's number three? I can hardly wait." "Seal them in an envelope and mail them to me." "I don't want to put you in jeopardy." "I'll figure it out. Really, it's enough to make me want to reform," I said. "Oh, yeah, and there's something else. The first time I went in..." "You've been in twice?" "Hey, the second time she invited me. That's when Gus was stranded in the shower. The first time I used his house key and made a note of all the medications he was on. I wondered if maybe a drug combination was causing his confusion and making him sleep. The pharmacist I talked to suggested possible pain pill or alcohol abuse, which is neither here nor there. This is the point. When I was cruising through the house, thinking Gus and Solana were gone, I opened the door to the third bedroom and there was this 300-pound goon asleep in the bed. Who the hell was he?" "Might have been the orderly she hired. She mentioned him when I was over there. He comes in once a day to help get Gus on and off the toilet and things like that." "But why was he sleeping on the job?" "He might have stayed so she could have a day off." "Don't think so. She was out with Gus running an errand of some kind. Come to think of it, why wasn't the orderly there to help when she had to get Gus out of the shower? Maybe he'd already come and gone. She said he's paid by the hour, so he probably isn't there for long. If you see him over there again, let me know. Melanie never said a word about Solana hiring help." I went back to my place at 7 with a buzz on. A happy consequence of my anxiety was my appetite was gone. In the absence of food, I was turning into a drunk. I glanced at my desk and saw the message light blinking on my answering machine. I crossed the room and pressed the play button. Hey, Kenzie. Richard Compton here. Could you give me a call? What was this about? I'd done a couple of jobs for the man in the previous week, so maybe he had more. I was willing to do just about anything to keep myself out of my own neighborhood. I dialed the number he left, and when he picked up, I identified myself. Thanks for returning my call. Look, I'm sorry to bother you on a Saturday night, but I need a favor. Sure. I have to fly up to San Francisco tomorrow at 6 a.m. I thought I'd better catch you now instead of calling from the airport. Good plan. So, what's the favor? I got a message from the fellow in the apartment above the Guffey's place. He thinks they're getting ready to decamp. So the unlawful detainer did the trick? Looks that way. That's a blessing. A big one. Problem is, I'm gone until Friday, and I won't have a chance to do the final inspection and pick up the keys. You'll be changing the locks anyway, so why sweat the keys? True, but I made them pay a $20 key deposit plus a $100 cleaning deposit. If someone doesn't go out there, they'll swear up and down the place was immaculate and they left the keys in plain sight. Then they'll turn around and want both deposits back in full. Obviously, you don't have to do it right this minute. Any time before noon on Monday would be fine. I can go tomorrow if you like. No sense inconveniencing yourself. I'll give them a call and tell them you'll be there Monday. You want to give me a time? 11:15? That way I can take care of it before I break for lunch. Good. I'll let them know. I'll be staying at the Hyatt on Union Square if you need to reach me. He gave me the phone number of his hotel and I jotted it down. Look, Richard, I'm happy to help you out, but I'm not in the property management business. You should really hire a professional to handle things like this. I could, sweetie, but you're much cheaper. A management company would take 10% of the gross. I might have responded, but he'd hung up. When I left my apartment Monday morning, I found myself scanning the street in the front of Gus's house, hoping to avoid an encounter with Solana. I didn't trust myself to have a civil conversation with her. I started my car and pulled away from the curb in haste, unable to resist the urge to crane my neck for some sign of her. I thought I caught movement in the window, but it was probably a fresh surge of paranoia kicking in. I reached the office and let myself in. I gathered the mail from Saturday that had been shoved through the slot and now lay in a wide lake on the rug in my reception area. My answering machine was winking merrily. I separated the junk mail and tossed it in the wastebasket while I punched the play button. The message was from Geneva Burt in Lowell Effinger's office. She sounded harried, but her Mondays were probably like that. I dialed the law firm while I was in the process of opening the bills, the phone pressed between my right ear and my shoulder in a hands-free, hunched position. When Geneva picked up on her end, I identified myself and said, "What's up?"
"Oh, hi, Kinsey. Thanks for returning my call. I'm having a devil of a time connecting with Mr. Downs."
"He's supposed to call you. That's why I gave him your number in the first place. He doesn't have a phone, so he gets his messages through his landlady. It seemed simpler all around to have him make the contact since he's so difficult to reach."
"I understand, and I passed along your comment about how antsy he is. Mr. Effinger's anxious to take his deposition, so he asked me to go ahead and call and get something on the books. I've tried 3 times this morning, and I can't get anyone to pick up. I hate to do this to you, but he's leaning on me, so I gotta turn around and lean on you. Let me see what I can do. I don't think he works Mondays, so I may be able to catch him at home. You have a date and time set? If so, I'll make sure he puts it on his calendar."
"Oh, not yet. We'll accommodate his schedule once we know what's good for him."
"Great. I'll get back to you as soon as I've talked to him. If he's at all resistant, I'll put him in my car and drive him over there myself."
"Thanks."
I got in my car and looped back up Santa Teresa Street and covered the 8 blocks, making the 2 left turns that put me on Dave Levine. The residence hotel came into view, and for once, there was a decent parking place out front. I left my car at the curb and took the porch steps 2 at a time. I pushed open the door and walked down the hall to Mrs. Vaughn's office in the rear. On the counter, there was an old-fashioned punch bell, and I gave it a ringy ding.
A young woman came out of the dining room with a feather duster in one hand. She was in her 20s, her hair skinned back and held in place with blue plastic combs. She wore a t-shirt and jeans, and she had a dust rag caught in a belt loop like a sous chef.
May I help you?
I'm looking for Mrs. Vaughn.
She's out running errands.
The phone on the desk behind her began to ring and ring and ring. She glanced at it, ignoring the obvious solution, which was to answer it.
Is there something I can help you with?
The ringing stopped. Possibly, I said. Do you know if Mr. Downs is in?
He's gone.
The man's always gone. Any idea when he'll be back?
He moved out. I'm supposed to clean the place, but I haven't gotten to it yet. Mrs. Vaughn's putting a notice in the paper that the room's for rent. That's partly what she's doing while she's out.
You can't be serious. I talked to him on Saturday, and he never said a word.
When did he give notice?
He didn't. He just packed up and left.
Whatever you said to him, you must have scared him away, she said with a laugh.
I stood rooted in place. What in the world would I tell Lowell Effinger? Melvin Downs' statement was crucial to his case, and now the guy had cut and run.
Can I take a look at his room? Mrs. Vaughn wouldn't like that.
10 minutes, please. That's all I ask. She doesn't have to know. She thought about that and seemed to shrug.
Door's unlocked, so you can walk around if you want. Not that there's anything to see.
I peeked in first thing to see if he'd left a mess behind. It's as clean as a whistle as far as I can tell.
Thanks.
Don't mention it.
And I mean that.
I'm busy cleaning the kitchen. I don't know nothing about nothing if she catches you. I took the back stairs this time, worried I'd run into the returning Mrs. Vaughn if I used the main staircase. From below, I could hear the ringing of the phone start up again. Maybe the cleaning woman was on orders not to answer it. Maybe Cleaning Personnel Union number 409 forbade her taking on duties that weren't specified by contract. When I got to the third floor, just to be on the safe side, I tapped at Melvin Downs' door and waited a beat. When no one responded to my knock, I checked the hall in both directions and then opened the door. I stepped into his room with the same heightened sense of danger I felt every time I found myself someplace I wasn't supposed to be, which was much of the time these days. I closed my eyes and inhaled. The room smelled of aftershave. I opened them again and did a visual survey. The dimensions were unexpectedly generous. Probably 16 by 20 feet. The closet was large enough to accommodate a wide chest of drawers with two wooden rods for hanging clothes and a shoe rack attached to the back of the door. Above the hanging rods, there were empty wood shelves that reached all the way to the ceiling. The adjacent bathroom was 12 by 12 with an old cast iron clawfoot tub and a sink with a wide lip, a small glass shelf above. The toilet had a wooden seat and a wall-mounted tank that was operated by a pull chain. The floors were covered in a parquet pattern of fake wood linoleum. In the main room, there was a second chest of drawers, a double bed with a white-painted iron bedstead, and two mismatched bed tables. The one table lamp was utilitarian, two 75-watt bulbs, a hanging metal chain, and a plain yellowing shade that looked scorched in places. When I pulled the chain, only one bulb came on. The bed had been stripped, and the mattress was folded back on itself, revealing the bed springs. Melvin had made a tidy pile of the linens that would need to be washed. Sheets, pillowcases, mattress cover, bedspread, and towels. Under a bay of windows on the far wall, there was a wooden table painted white and two unfinished wooden chairs. I crossed to a length of kitchen counter with a short run of cabinets above. I checked the shelves, a set of dishes, 6 drinking glasses, 2 cereal boxes, and an assortment of crackers. Knowing Mrs. Vaughn as I did by then, a hot plate or any other cooking equipment would be strictly forbidden. I began to search in earnest, though I didn't see much in the way of hiding places. I pulled each drawer open, looked in and behind, checked the underside, and then closed it and moved on. Nothing in the wastebasket. Nothing under the chest of drawers. I took one of the kitchen chairs and carried it to the closet so I could climb up and get a clear view of the far reaches of the shelves. I pulled the string that controlled the one naked bulb.
The light was dull. At first, I thought I'd struck out again, but I could see something in one corner against the wall. I stood on my toes, head down, my arm fully extended as I groped blindly across the dusty shelf. My hand closed over the item, and I hauled it into view. It was one of those toys with two parallel wooden sticks, which, when squeezed, makes a small wooden clown do a somersault. I watched the clown do a couple of flips and then climbed down off the chair. I returned the chair to the kitchenette and stuck the toy in my bag before I moved into the bathroom. The bathroom hadn't been scrubbed, but neither did it contain anything in the way of information. I did see the cardboard insert from a wine box, folded flat and tucked behind the sink. Melvin Downs had been carrying two wine boxes, one tucked inside the other, when we were introduced, which meant he was already in the process of packing up his things. Interesting. Something had triggered a hasty departure, and I hoped it wasn't me. I left the room and closed the door behind me. As I headed toward the stairs, I heard the faint strains of a radio from the room across the hall. I hesitated, and then knocked on the door. What did I have to lose? The man who answered was missing his upper front teeth and had a prickling 2-day growth of beard. Sorry to bother you, but I'm wondering what happened to Melvin Downs.
Don't know. Don't care. I didn't like him, and he didn't like me. Good riddance.
Is there anyone else I might talk to?
Him and the fellow in 5 watch TV together, second floor.
Is he here? He closed the door. I said, thanks. I went out to my car and got in, then sat with my hands on the steering wheel while I considered my options. I glanced at my watch. It was close to 11 o'clock. For the moment, there was nothing I could do. I had the Guffeys to contend with. So I turned the key in the ignition and headed for Colgate. If I didn't get a move on, I'd be late. Chapter 24. Solana. Sunday morning. Solana stood in the kitchen, breaking up a handful of tablets with a mortar and pestle. The pulverized medication was a new over-the-counter sleep aid she'd purchased the day before. She liked to experiment. The old man was currently sedated, and she took the opportunity to place a call to the other, to whom she hadn't spoken since before Christmas. Given the press of the holidays and her care of the old man, Solana hadn't given the other much thought. She felt safe where she was. She couldn't see how her past could catch up with her, but it never hurt to keep a finger on the other's pulse, as it were. After the usual, banal conversation, the other said, I had the oddest thing happen. I was in the neighborhood of Sunrise House and stopped by to see the gang and say hi. There's a new woman in the administrator's office, and she asked me if I was enjoying my new job. When I said I was in school full-time, she gave me this look. I can't even tell you how strange it was. I asked what was wrong, and she said a private investigator had come in doing a background check for a private-duty nursing job. I told her she'd made a mistake, that I wasn't doing private duty. Solana closed her eyes, trying to determine what this meant. She must have made a mistake, thinking you were someone else. That was my reaction, but while I was standing there, she pulled the folder and pointed out the note she'd entered at the time. She even showed me the woman's business card. Solana focused on the information with a curious sense of detachment. Woman? It wasn't a name I'd seen before. I can't remember it now, but I don't like the idea of someone asking personal questions about me. I have to go. There's someone at the door. I'll call you later. Solana hung up. She could feel the heat climb her frame like a hot flash. What alarmed Solana was the fact that the young woman from next door was prying into matters that were none of her concern. The revelation was deeply disturbing, but she couldn't stop and worry about that now. She had other business to take care of. She'd set up an appointment at an art gallery where she was hoping to offload the painting she'd found when she first came to work. She knew nothing about art, but the frames were handsome, and she believed they would bring in a tidy sum. She'd gone through the yellow pages and selected 5 or 6 galleries in the fancy pants part of town.
As soon as Tiny helped her load the paintings in the trunk of her car, she'd take off, leaving him to babysit Mr. Vronsky while she was out. She left the freeway and took the old coast road, which ran through the part of Montebello known as the Lower Village. There was nothing remotely village-like about the area. It was all high-end retail businesses, custom clothing, interior design shops, architects' offices, real estate offices with color photographs of $10 to $15 million homes in the window. She spotted the gallery in the middle of a line of stores. Parking was at a premium, and she circled the block twice before she found a space. She opened the trunk of the convertible and took out two of the six paintings she'd brought. On both, the frames were ornate, and she was sure the gold leaf was real. The gallery itself was plain, long, and narrow. No carpet, no furniture except for an expensive antique table with a chair on each side. The lighting was good, calling attention to the 30 or so paintings hung along the walls. Some looked no better than the two she'd carried in. The woman at the desk looked up with a pleasant smile.
"You must be Ms. Tassinato. I'm Karis Mumford. How are you today?"
Solana said, "Fine. I have an appointment with the owner to talk about some paintings I want to sell."
"I'm the owner. Won't you have a seat?"
Solana was slightly embarrassed by the error she'd made, but how was she to know someone so young and attractive would own a ritzy place like this? She'd expected a man, someone older and snooty and easy to manipulate. Awkwardly, she set the paintings down, wondering how to proceed. Ms. Mumford got up and came around the table, saying,
"Mind if I have a look?"
"Please." She picked up the larger of the two paintings and carried it across the room. She leaned it against the wall, then returned for the second painting, which she placed beside it. Solana watched the woman's expression change. She couldn't decipher the woman's reaction, and she felt a moment of uneasiness. The paintings looked okay to her, but maybe the gallery owner thought they were inferior.
"How did you acquire these?"
"They're not mine. I work for the gentleman who hopes to sell them because he needs the cash. His wife bought them years ago, but after she died, he didn't have much use for them. They've been stored in a spare room, just taking up space." Karis Mumford said, "Do you know these two artists?"
"I don't. I never cared for landscapes myself. Mountains and poppies, or whatever those orange flowers are. Maybe you're thinking these aren't as good as the paintings you have, but the frames are worth a lot," she said, trying not to sound desperate or apologetic. Karis Mumford looked at her with surprise.
"All you're selling are the frames? I assumed you were talking about the paintings.
I'd be willing to throw those in. Is something wrong?"
"Not at all. This is a John Gamble, one of the plein air painters from the early part of the century. His work is highly sought after. I haven't seen a painting of this size in years. The other is by William Wendt, another well-known plein air painter. If you're not in any hurry, I have two or three clients I'm certain would be interested. It's just a matter of reaching them."
"How long would that take?"
"A week to 10 days. These are people who travel most of the year, and it's sometimes a trick catching up with them. At the same time, they trust my judgment. If I say these are authentic, they'll take my word for it."
"I'm not sure I should leave them. I'm not authorized to do that," she said.
"That's up to you, though an interested buyer would want to see the painting and perhaps take it home for a few days before making a decision." Solana could just imagine it. This woman would pass the paintings on to someone else, and that's the last she'd ever see of them. This Gamble fellow, what would you say that one's worth? She could feel her palms dampen. She didn't like negotiating in a situation like this where she wasn't on solid ground.
"Well, I sold a similar painting 2 months ago for $125,000.
Another client, a couple, bought a Gamble from me 5 or 6 years ago for $35,000. Now it's worth $150,000.
$150,000, Solana said. Surely her ears weren't deceiving her.
The Mumford woman went on, "If you don't mind my asking, is there a reason you can't leave these with me?"
"It's not me. It's the gentleman I work for. I might talk him into leaving them for a week, but
not longer, I'd need a receipt. I'd need two receipts. I'd be happy to oblige. Of course, I'd need to see the two bills of sale from the original purchase, or some proof the gentleman actually owns the paintings. It's a formality, but in transactions of this magnitude, the provenance is critical. Solana shook her head, inventing a backstory as quickly as she could. Not possible. His wife bought them years ago. There was a fire after that, and all his financial records were destroyed. Anyway, what difference does it make after all these years? What matters is the current value. This is an authentic gamble. A big one. You said so yourself. What about an appraisal for insurance purposes? Surely he has a rider on his policy to protect himself in case of loss. That I don't know about, but I can ask. She could see the woman turning the problem over in her mind. This business of provenance was just an excuse to bring the price down. Maybe she thought the painting was stolen, which couldn't be further from the truth. The woman wanted the paintings. Solana could see it in her face, like someone on a diet looking at a rack of donuts through a plate glass window. Finally, the gallery owner said, "Let me think about it, and maybe we can find a way. Give me a number where you can be reached, and I'll get back to you in the morning." When Solana left the gallery, she had the two receipts in hand. The lesser of the two paintings, the William Went, was valued at $75,000. The other four paintings in the trunk, she'd hold on to until she was satisfied she'd been treated well. It was worth waiting a week, if she could have that much cash in hand. Home again, she found herself brooding on the issue of Kinsey Milhone, who seemed determined to snoop. Solana vividly recalled the first time she'd knocked on Mr. Vronsky's door. She'd despised the girl on sight, staring at her through the pane, as though she were a tarantula in one of the glass cases at the Museum of Natural History. Solana had taken Tiny there often as a child. He was fascinated by the variety of disgusting insects and spiders, hairy things that lurked in corners and under leaves. Some had horns and pincers and hard black carapaces. These loathsome creatures could disguise themselves so cunningly that it was sometimes hard to spot them in the foliage where they hid. Tarantulas were the worst. The display case would appear empty, and Solana would wonder if the spider had escaped. She'd lean toward the glass, searching uneasily, and suddenly discover the thing was close enough to touch. This girl was like that. Solana had opened the door to her, picking up her scent as clearly as an animal's, something feminine and floral that didn't suit her at all. She was slim, in her 30s, with a wiry, athletic build. That first encounter, she wore a black turtleneck t-shirt, a winter jacket, jeans, and tennis shoes, with a slouchy-looking leather bag slung over one shoulder. Her dark hair was straight and carelessly cut, as if she'd done it herself. Since then, she'd presented herself on numerous occasions, always with the same lame compliments and clumsy questions about the old man. Twice, Solana had caught sight of her jogging along State Street early in the morning. She gathered the young woman did this weekday mornings before the sun was up. Solana wondered if she went out before dawn to spy on her. She'd seen her peering into the dumpster when she passed it on the street. What Solana did, what Solana put there, was none of her business. Solana forced herself to remain calm and polite in dealing with the Milhone woman, though she kept her fixed in an unrelenting stare. The young woman's brows were lightly feathered, green eyes set in a fringe of dark lashes. The hazel of her eyes was eerie, green with gold flecks, and a lighter ring around the iris that made her eyes blaze like a wolf's. Watching her, Solana felt a sensation wash over her that was nearly sexual. They were kindred spirits, dark to dark. Usually Solana could look straight into others' minds, but not this one. While Kinsey's manner was friendly, her comments hinted at a curiosity Solana didn't care for. She was someone who took in far more than she let on. The day she'd offered to go to the market, she'd given herself away. Solana had gone to the kitchen to make up her grocery list.
She'd hung a mirror in the kitchen beside the back door, and she steadied herself now. She was fine. She looked good, exactly as she claimed. Caring, concerned, a woman who had her patient's best interests at heart. When she returned to the living room, purse under one arm, her wallet in hand, she saw that instead of waiting on the porch as she'd been asked, she'd stepped into the house. The gesture was small, but it smacked of willfulness. This was someone who did what she wanted and not as she was told. Solana could tell she'd had a quick look around. What had she seen that day? Solana had longed to scan the room to see if anything was amiss, but she'd kept her gaze pinned on the young woman's face. She was dangerous. Solana didn't like her persistence, though now that she thought about it, she hadn't seen Kinsey for 2 or 3 days. This past Friday, she'd gone next door looking for help getting the old man out of the shower. Mr. Pitts was out, and Kinsey had come over instead. Solana hadn't cared which of them it was. Her purpose was to drop the remark about the old man's fall. Not because he'd fallen. How could he, when she scarcely let him out of bed? But as a way of accounting for the fresh bruises on his legs. She hadn't seen Kinsey since, and that seemed odd. She and Mr. Pitts were always expressing such concern about the old man. So why not now? The two were clearly in cahoots, but what were they up to? Tiny had told her that Thursday, while he was napping, he heard someone moving around in Gus's house. Solana didn't see how it could have been Kinsey, because as far as she knew, the woman didn't have a key. All the same, Solana'd called a locksmith and had the locks changed. She thought back to the other's tale about the woman investigator asking questions at the senior facility where the two of them had worked. Clearly, she'd been sticking her nose where it didn't belong. Solana went back to the old man's room. He was awake, and he'd struggled into a sitting position on the side of his bed. His bare feet dangled, and one hand was outstretched, clutching the bed table for support. She clapped her hands loudly. "Good! You're up! Would you like some help?" She startled him so badly, she could almost feel the jolt of fear that had shot up his spine. "Bathroom!" "Why don't you wait here, and I'll bring the bedpan?" "You're entirely too wobbly to be prancing around the house." She held the bedpan for him, but he couldn't pass any urine. No big surprise. That was just an excuse for his getting out of bed. She couldn't imagine what he thought to accomplish. She'd moved his walker to the empty bedroom, so in order to get anywhere, he'd have to creep from room to room, holding onto the furniture for support. Even if he reached the back door, or the front door for that matter, he'd have to negotiate the porch steps and the sidewalk beyond. She thought she might allow him to escape and get as far as the street before she brought him back. Then she could tell the neighbors he'd taken to wandering off. She'd say, "Poor old thing. In his flimsy pajamas, he could catch his death of cold." She'd say he'd been hallucinating as well. Crazy talk about people being after him. Mr. Vronsky's efforts had left him shaking, which she could have warned him about if he'd asked. She helped him into the living room so he could watch his favorite television show. She sat beside him on the sofa and apologized for losing her temper. Even though he'd provoked her, she swore it wouldn't happen again. She was fond of him, she said. He needed her, and she needed him. "Without me, you'd have to go into a nursing home. How would you like that?" "I want to stay here." "Of course you do, and I'll do everything I can to help you. But no complaints. You must never talk to anyone about me."
"I won't."
"That young woman who comes over. You know who I mean." The old man nodded, not meeting her gaze. "If you complain to her, if you communicate in any way, Tiny will hurt her badly, and the fault will be yours. Do you understand?"
"I won't say anything," he whispered.
"That's a good boy," she said. "Now that you have me, you'll never be lonely again." He seemed grateful and humble in the wake of her kindness. When his show was over, as a reward for his good behavior, She fondled him in a way that would help him relax. Afterward, he was docile, and she sensed the bond that was building between them. Their physical relationship was new, but she'd bided her time, easing him into it day by day. He'd been raised a gentleman, and he'd never admit what she did to him. She'd been smart to get rid of the volunteer from Meals on Wheels. She didn't like leaving the back door unlocked, and she loathed Mrs. Dell with her fancy salon hairdo and pricey mink coat. She was totally absorbed in her do-gooder image of herself. If Solana was present when she arrived with the meals, she might offer a pleasantry, but there was no conversation between them, and the woman seldom thought to ask about the old man. Solana had put a halt to the service, nonetheless. There was always the chance that she might notice something and report it to someone else. Monday morning, Solana gave the old man a double dose of his medicine. He'd sleep for 2 solid hours, which would give her plenty of time to drive to Colgate and back. She needed to get home to see what Tiny was up to. She couldn't quite count on him to stay put. She thought she'd bring him back to the house again so she'd have help getting Gus in and out of the shower when he woke. As long as she kept a close eye on the old man, it was probably a smart move to let him have visitors now and again. Before she left, she unplugged the phone in his room and stood by the bed, watching him. As soon as his breathing was deep and regular, she put on her coat and picked up her purse and car keys. As she was turning the thumb lock, she heard the muffled slam of a car door, and she stopped in her tracks. An engine started up. She stepped over to the window and stood to one side with her back to the wall. From that angle, she had a truncated view of the street, but she wouldn't be visible to anyone outside. When the blue Mustang passed, she saw Kinsey lean forward, craning as though to get one more look at the house. What was so interesting? For the second time, Solana turned and surveyed the room. Her gaze brushed past the desk and came back. There was something different. She crossed the room and stood there, studying the cubbyholes, trying to figure out what had changed. She pulled out the packet of bankbooks and suffered a painful stab of surprise. Someone had taken off the rubber band and removed the passbook for one of the savings accounts. In addition, the checkbook seemed thinner, and when she opened it, she realized the register was gone. Oh, dear God. Her gaze returned to the window. 2 people had been in the house during the past week. Mr. Pitts and the infuriating Kinsey Milhone. One of them had done this. But how had they managed it, and when? As she unlocked the door to her apartment, she knew the place was empty. The television set was dark. The kitchen counters were littered with the dregs of his meals over the past few days. She moved down the short hall to Tiny's room and flipped on the overhead light. She was a neat person by nature. She was always appalled by his slovenly ways. She'd badgered him incessantly as a boy, forcing him to tidy his room before she allowed him to do anything else. By the time he reached his teens, he outweighed her by 150 pounds, and all the nagging in the world had no effect. He'd sit and look at her with those big cow eyes, but what she said and what she did had no power to move him. She could beat on him all day long, but it only made him laugh. Next to him, she was small and ineffectual. She'd given up her attempts to change or control him. The best she could hope for now was to confine his messes to the home front. Unfortunately, now that she was spending most of her time with the old man, Tiny felt free to live any way he pleased. She checked the bathroom they shared and was annoyed at the sight of his bloody handprints. Sometimes he liked to punch and cut, and he wasn't always good at cleaning up after himself. She went into her room and spent a few minutes picking up the pantyhose, underwear, and discarded clothing strewn on the floor. Some of the flashier garments she hadn't had occasion to wear in years. Having tidied up, she gathered the articles she wanted to take with her to the old man's house. She was beginning to like it there, and she was determined to stay. She'd put the machinery in motion, as she had twice before, in her search for permanence. She wanted to set down roots. She wanted to feel free, without having to look over her shoulder to see if the law was catching up with her. She was tired of living like a gypsy, always on the move. She had a fleeting fantasy of life without anyone getting in her way. Mr. Vronsky was tiresome. He had his uses, for now, at any rate. Her current problem was rounding up Tiny, her Tonto, who usually didn't go far by day. If he disappeared after supper, there was no point in wondering where he'd gone or what he was up to. She locked the apartment and returned to her car, prepared to circle the neighborhood in search of him. There was a service station with an auto repair garage where he liked to hang out. Something about the smell of hot metal and grease appealed to him. Also the car wash next door. He liked watching the dirty vehicles go in the one end and come out the other end, clean and dripping with water. He could stand for an hour looking at the swinging lengths of canvas that swished against the sides and over the tops of the cars. He loved the twisted worms of soap that shot out on the tires, and the hot wax spray that made the finish shiny. For a while, she hoped he'd get a job there, wiping the beads of moisture from cars at the end of the run. That was something he could do. Tiny thought about life in concrete terms. What was happening right now? What was set in front of him? What he wanted to eat? What warranted a scolding? What netted him a swat? His view of the world was flat and uncomplicated. He was a man with no curiosity and no personal insight. He had no ambition and no urge to do anything except fritter away his time watching television at home and then doing whatever he did when he went out. Better not to pursue that issue, she thought. Solana drove the streets slowly and kept a sharp eye out for the bulk of him. He'd be wearing his denim jacket. He'd have his black watch cap pulled down around his ears. No sign of him at the service station. No sign of him at the car wash. She finally spotted him coming out of the corner mini-mart. She'd passed the mom-and-pop market before, but he must have been inside, buying cigarettes and candy bars with the money she'd left for him. She slowed to a stop and honked. He lumbered over to the car and got in on the passenger's side, slamming the door. He was smoking a cigarette and chewing gum. What a bumpkin he was. "Put that out. You know I don't allow you to smoke in my car." She watched him roll the window down and toss out his lighted cigarette. He stuck his fingers in his jacket pockets, clearly tickled about something. Irritated, she went on. "What are you so happy about?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing's not a word. Say nothing. What's in your pocket?" He shook his head as though he didn't know what she meant. "Did you steal something?" He said no, but his tone was grumpy. He was too simple to lie, and she knew by the expression on his face that she'd caught him again. She pulled over to the curb. "Empty your pockets right now." He made a show of disobeying, but she smacked him in the head and he complied, taking out two small bags of M&Ms and a packet of beef jerky. "What's the matter with you? Last time you did this, I told you never again. Didn't I say that to you? What's going to happen if you get caught?" She rolled the window down and tossed out the treats. He set up a wail, making the mooing sound that so annoyed her. He was the only person she knew who actually said the word "wah" when he cried. "No more stealing, you hear me? And none of that other stuff. Because you know, I can send you back to that ward. Do you remember where you were? Do you remember what they did to you?"
"Yeah."
"Well, they can do that again if I say the word." She studied him. What was the point in reprimanding the boy? He did what he did in the hours when he was gone. Many days she'd caught sight of his hands, knuckles darkly bruised and swollen like mitts. She shook her head in despair. She knew if she pushed him too far, he'd turn on her as he had in the past. When she reached the block they lived on, she turned down the alleyway searching for a parking spot. Most of the slots in the carport were empty. The apartment complex behind theirs had a constant turnover of tenants, which meant that parking spaces were available on a shifting basis as renters came and went. She caught sight of a blue Mustang parked in the fire lane at the end of the alley, tucked up along the side of the building.
She couldn't believe her eyes. No one parked there. A sign had been posted saying it was a fire lane and had to be kept clear. Solana rolled on by, turning to stare at the vehicle. She knew whose it was. She'd seen it less than an hour before. What was Kinsey doing here? She could feel the ripples of panic rising in her chest. She made a small sound, somewhere between a gasp and a moan. Tiny said, "What's the matter?" leaving out most of the consonants and flattening the vowels. She turned from the alleyway onto the street. "We're not stopping here right now. I'll take you to the Waffle House and buy you breakfast. You should quit smoking. It's bad for you." Chapter 25. At 11:10 Monday morning, I climbed the stairs to the second floor of the three-story apartment building where the Guffeys lived. I could hear a steady splatting of water and assumed the gardener or a maintenance man was hosing down the walks. I hadn't had the pleasure of meeting Grant Guffey, but his wife was hostile, and I wasn't looking forward to another pissing contest. Why had I agreed to do this? During the walkthrough, even if I saw great gaping holes in the walls, they'd deny responsibility, swearing up and down that the holes had been there from day one. I didn't have a copy of the inspection sheet they'd signed when they took the place. I knew Compton was meticulous about this phase of the rental process, which was what allowed him to be so tough on his tenants when they moved out. If there was visible damage and the Guffeys protested, we'd be reduced to a ridiculous did-to-did-not argument. I'd left my car in the alleyway below, parked close to the building, at an angle where it wouldn't be visible from their back window. Not that they'd know my car, but a touch of caution is never a bad thing. The spot was posted as a fire lane, but I hoped I wouldn't be there long. If I heard sirens or smelled smoke, I'd run like a little bunny and retrieve my poor vehicle before it was crushed by a fire truck. This was the last time I was doing Compton's dirty work. It wasn't like I was doing it for free, but I had other business to take care of. The specter of Melvin Downs flickered across my mind, bringing with it a slow, heavy dread. When I reached the top of the stairs, I could see a widening pool of water pouring from under the door to apartment 18. The flood was spilling over the edge of the second floor walkway, hitting the concrete patio below, creating the illusion of rain I'd heard mere moments before. Oh, joy. I waded to the front door, creating ripples as I went. The drapes had been pulled across the window so I couldn't see in. But when I knocked, the door swung inward on a creaking hinge. In movies, this is the moment when the audience wants to scream a warning. "Don't go in there, you twit!" A door swinging open usually signifies a body on the floor, and the fearless detective will be blamed for the shooting after foolishly picking up the weapon to inspect it for gunpowder residue. I was too smart for that. Gingerly, I peered in. The water was now flirting with the tops of my tennis shoes, thus soaking my socks. The place was not only empty, but thoroughly trashed. Water was gushing out of the bathroom from numerous ruptured plumbing fixtures. Sink, shower, shattered toilet, and tub. The wall-to-wall carpet had been shredded with a sharp instrument, and the strands leaned away from the rush of water like long, waving grass in a fast-moving stream. The kitchen cabinets had been ripped off the wall and left in a splintered pile in the middle of the floor. If the place had come furnished, all the furniture had been stolen or sold, because aside from a few coat hangers, there was nothing else to be seen. At the rate the water was flowing, I thought it was a safe bet to anticipate a virtual rainforest in the apartment below. My tennis shoes made a squishing sound as I backed out the door. A man said, "Hey!" I looked up. A fellow was bending over the third floor railing. I shaded my eyes to see him against the glare. "Got a problem down there?" he asked. "Can I use your phone? I need to call the police." "I figured as much, so I called him myself. If that's your car out back, you better move it or you'll get ticketed." "Thanks. Do you have any idea where I can find the water shut-off valve?" "Clueless." After moving my car, I spent the next hour with the county sheriff's deputy, who'd arrived 10 minutes after the call went out.
While I waited, I'd gone down to apartment 10 and knocked, but couldn't rouse anyone. The tenants were probably off at work and wouldn't learn of the watery disaster until 5 o'clock that day. The deputy managed to get the water turned off, which brought out a second round of tenants, outraged and distressed by the interruption to their service. One woman emerged, wrapped in a terry cloth bathrobe, her hair in a helmet of bubbling shampoo. I borrowed the upstairs neighbor's phone and called the Hyatt in San Francisco, swearing I'd leave him money for the long-distance charges. Miraculously, Richard Compton was in his hotel room. When I told him what was going on, he said, "Shit." He gnawed on the problem for a moment and then said, "Okay, I'll take care of it. Sorry to put you through this. You want to call a restoration company about the water damage? They can at least get big fans and dehumidifiers out here. If you don't get right on it, the floors will warp and you'll have mold growing in the walls. I'll get the manager from another building started on that. He can call the company we use. Meantime, I'll get in touch with my insurance agent and have him send someone out. I guess the Guffeys won't be getting their deposit back." He laughed, but not much. After we'd hung up, I took a moment to assess the situation. Between Melvin Downs's disappearance and the Guffeys' vandalism, I didn't see how things could get worse. Which just goes to show how little I know about life. The rest of Monday was uneventful. Tuesday morning, I took my metaphorical hat in hand and met with Lowell Effinger to deliver the news about Melvin Downs. I'd seen Effinger on two previous occasions, and our dealings thereafter had been conducted on the phone. Sitting across the desk from him, I noticed how tired he looked, smoky gray pouches under his eyes. He was a man in his early 60s with a tangle of curly hair that had turned from salt and pepper to white since I had seen him last. He had a strong chin and jaw, but his face looked as crumpled as a paper bag. I wondered if he had personal problems, but I didn't know him well enough to ask. He spoke in a deep voice that rumbled up from his chest.
"You know where he worked?"
"Not specifically. Probably near City College, because that's where he caught the bus. When the driver told me where he lived, I was so busy trying to connect with him there, I didn't worry about where he worked."
"If he moved out of his room, he probably quit his job, don't you think?"
"Well, it's worth pursuing in any event. I'll go back over to the hotel and talk to Mrs. Vaughn. I've seen her so often, she might as well adopt me by now. She claims a policy of minding her own business, but I'll bet she knows more than she's told me so far. I can also talk to some of the other residents while I'm there."
"Do what you can. If nothing turns up in the next few days, we'll revisit the issue."
I wish I'd been quicker. When I talked to him Saturday, he gave no indication he was planning to leave. Of course, he'd just gone out and scored a couple of cardboard boxes, but it didn't occur to me he'd be using them to pack. 30 minutes later, I found myself at the residence hotel.